are listening to STR, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. And today we are going to be reviewing The Unwritten by Mike Carey and Peter Gross. And so, as a general overview, this is the second book in the series, the second trade in the series. And this story is a loose take on Harry Potter and then Tom Taylor. It would be as if, so the loose take on Harry Potter is Tommy Taylor would be the Harry Potter for this world. And the twist is that there's a real Tom Taylor who's the son of the author. It'd be like if J.K. Rowling had a son named Harry Potter.
Right.
But the other twist is that somehow events have changed. He's grown up now. He's in his early 30s,
right.
late 20s.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, events from the book and characters from the book are kind of popping up, but we don't really know
if it's really happening. Yeah, it's like the lines between fantasy and reality get blurred, and then... it's really hard, and it's hard. Tom/Tommy starts to question what is real and what, you know, how real is he? Because in the first volume, it's revealed that he has no birth certificate. There's no history of him, really. He just kind of came into existence, basically.
Uh-huh.
And now, you know, as events in Volume 1 and now in Volume 2 unfold, it continues to make him question that.
And so another layer on top of that is that his father has drilled into him literary events.
Right.
And places where books or literary pieces of fiction have been written and also take place fictionally.
Right. So in Volume 1, for example, he's walking through London and notes the building that George Orwell used as a model in 1984, even though it wasn't really the actual ministry or whatever, but it was the model for it. So that kind of thing. He sees London and the world as a series of literary landmarks as opposed to real landmarks.
Yeah, historic landmarks. Right. They're literary historic
landmarks.
Landmarks. And so we both really enjoyed Volume 1 and couldn't wait to come back to Volume 2. So it's here now. Mm-hmm. How did you feel about Volume 2? Did it feel like a letdown? Did it continue your expectations?
You know, Volume 2 for me was... it was more challenging than Volume 1. Volume 1 was a real kind of... almost lighthearted romp, if you will, through this world, like you said, where, you know, could Harry Potter be real? You know, that kind of thing. And there was some fun magic thrown in. And yes, there was a ghastly murder in Volume 1, but it was all kind of in this, I don't know, comic booky fun thing. Volume 2 is very heavy. It's very literary based. I found myself going and, you know, reading lots of sort of supplementary material to go along with it as I read along, simply because the world all of a sudden got tied to literature a lot tighter than the first world did.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in the first world, like I said, there's kind of these sort of tossed off references.
We saw an inkling of that with the last chapter of the book. It was heavily literary referenced. It was a story about the creator of Jungle Book, right?
Yeah, Oscar. No, it was yes,
you're Oscar right. Wilde, and I'm totally spacing on who that is.
Rudyard Kipling.
Yes. And so that was kind of a hint, and that was what really excited me about that book. The rest of the story was good, but that's what really made the story great for me is that final twist at the end. And this kind of continued that for me and really kind of stretched that out over the whole story of this volume.
Right.
More so than the last one did. The last one I saw more as an introductory to this world and kind of some of the fantastical elements upon that. And this story really focused more on tying all those literary pieces into this world in a deeper way.
Right, and that's what I really appreciated is that, like I said, in the first one, it kind of seemed like neat little trivia pieces tossed in here and there.
Yeah.
And this one, I felt like in both of the main stories, it was intricately tied to the main story. And yeah. it basically begged you to go and read more and learn more. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah, I do as well. It made me feel almost stupid, yeah. which I haven't felt... You know, reading a comic book, I haven't felt stupid like that, you know, since maybe The Watchmen mm-hmm. or a book of that caliber, at least, right. where you know there's something deeper going on and you're not quite grasping it.
Right. And like I said, I mean, I found myself going and looking at things and, you know, I teach history in my day job. And so there was some references to a historical battle in this. And I found myself kind of going and looking at that and thinking, you know what? Here's a literary tie-in for when I teach this yeah. come the fall. And that's what's so great about this is that, you know, it's almost doing the same thing for us that's happening in the book. The lines between this book and the reality of this book and our world are getting, you know, blended and blurred ever uh-huh. so slightly the same way that, you know, Tommy's world is getting blended with this fantasy world that's happening in there.
And we really, I think, have kind of seen the true theme of what this series is about. In this book, it really explores the warping that fiction has upon reality and reality upon fiction and how that mm-hmm. goes both ways. And that's what the heart of this,
right.
the theme of this series really seems to be about.
And, you know, last series, I remember when we reviewed it, I talked about how I was concerned because... Mike Carey was asking readers what kinds of stories or what characters the readers wanted Tommy to come into contact yeah. with. And I was concerned about that because I prefer the writer to have a really clear vision. I think I got a glimpse for why he was asking that question in this, and I'm all for it now. I mean, yeah. I know I should have trusted him and all, but having seen what he did in this book, if that's the kind of direction he's going and he's going to take reader suggestions for, hey, let's explore this and let's really delve into this and let's look at, you know, like you said, how fiction and reality have shaped and warped each other, then wow, you know what? Hey, there's yeah. some great stuff out there that, you know, is ripe for exploration.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of a new take that I haven't really seen in at least the comic book genre. I don't know about in film or in actual literature, prose, but it's a completely new spin in comic books that I haven't mm-hmm. seen before. That's really refreshing.
It is. I mean, it's something that, like you said, it's not something you see. That's what we're looking for here is... something that is different than everything else on the shelves. I mean, you can go and find 50 different books with, you know, guys with capes and underwear on the outside. There's nothing else like unwritten on the shelves right now.
No.
And that's what makes it so great. It's got a distinct, unique voice to it.
The other thing that I appreciate, I graduated from college mostly with math and economics. I studied very little English and mm-hmm. literature, briefly touched on it. So a lot of these references really go over my head, but I do enjoy this story and it gives me a taste for enough for me to want to go explore those works that he's talking about beyond this book. But not knowing anything beyond that, I can still enjoy this book and it just kind of intrigues and teases me a little bit about what I should know.
Exactly. That's something that he does a great job in, is that you can not get the literary reference at all. And he will very deftly bring you up to speed on it.
Mm-hmm. In fact, at least enough for the story.
At least enough yeah. for the speed. And you know, that the introduction of the character of Richie Savoy this time gave Tom a voice to tell that to, without it being, you know, over the top and overly expository. It's a character that Tom can talk to and you know, as a literary device for the storyteller. It's a person for him to talk to give the reader the information that he needs, and a real reason for the to have to say it out loud. Mm-hmm. And like you said, it's enough for us, the reader, to get everything we need just from that conversation. Then, if it's something that intrigues you, that's where you go and you delve deeper, like I said, like I found myself doing.
So, we've kind of teased people enough, I mm-hmm. hope, that haven't read the series, that they're going to go out and pick it up. And from this point forward, we're going to reveal spoilers and really dig deep into this book.
Right. So if you haven't bought the book yet, go out, get it. It's from Vertigo. It's, what, $12.99. It is a great value. Volume 1 was only $9.99. It's really a great thing to pick up, get caught up. It is still early in the series. It's not like Walking Dead or something where you're going to spend, you know, $120 to get caught up.
You know, and I think you could almost start with this volume. There's a great recap page that kind of catches you up. You might be a little bit lost, but I think you could almost start with this.
Yeah, one. I mean, really, I think that if push came to shove, a person could read this volume here and have enough to go on. But yeah, so from this point on, if you have not read it, stop listening to us now. Go out, read
it. We're going to spoil the shit out of it.
Yeah, come back for the second half.
Okay, so like I said, one thing that I really appreciated is I picked up two books on the same week, and I was kind of thumbing through both, and both had been a while since I had read the first volume or the previous volume, and so just kind of thumbing through, this one I saw I had like a recap page, and I briefly read that recap page, and I was all of a sudden caught back up into right. this story, and so I immediately read this one, and the other one is still laying there unpicked up from before. And so that's one thing I really appreciated. He found a really clever way to recap, and yeah. that's through this kind of celebrity gossip website that we open up to and see what kind of has happened in the previous volume.
Right. And that, you know, like you said, there was enough in the previous volume that you have to know. And I think that the previous volume left off with enough of a cliffhanger to really make you wonder, how is Tommy going to get out of it? How is Tommy going to get out of being in prison?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I really appreciated about this was that the book had Tommy in prison and then got Tommy out of prison.
I mean, yeah, it really was, quickly.
It was not like, okay, here's the entire volume of Tommy in prison, and uh-huh. next volume we'll talk about how he's going to get out of prison, and then the third volume after that we're going to finally break him out. No, I mean, this was Tommy's in prison, and, you know, we're going to very quickly get him out. It was almost like the prison was the way that he could get Richie Savoy into the story.
I think beyond that, though, it also burned all of Tom's bridges. Like, he has no links to the real world now that he can kind of go back to. He's a wanted man and a fugitive on the run, and right. he has to kind of go forward without looking back at this point. And he has to kind of just go where he can go. And I think that was something important for Mike Carey to do, is to cut his ties to the past so that he couldn't just keep languishing on reality or the real world and really delve further into
mm-hmm.
this. Mm-hmm. He kind of just has to go with it because he's stuck in prison, and if he doesn't go with it, he's not getting out of prison.
Right.
And he has to spend the rest of his life, you know, in prison or get killed by the people that want to kill him.
Yeah, and that was a great move to get him out of this. I'm going to go to all the places I've ever lived, and I'm going to go to all the places my dad ever wrote and all those things. And so, yeah, like you said, it takes the mystery concept and sort of turns it on his head, because instead of going to all the places where Tommy has been, he now has to go to all the places he's never been, but uh-huh. his dad has told him about.
Yeah.
And that's where he has the map. The map filled with you know, all these post-it notes sort of is the stories or whatever that he has to somehow come in contact with. He has to somehow solve the mystery of each of these stories and figure out what it is he needs to do to sort of set it right.
Mm-hmm. And so we also see, what I think is the appearance of his nemesis.
The Count.
Yeah, the Count becomes... I didn't really understand how he emerges into this world in the way that he did.
All right. I thought that that whole story... The book is divided into three stories, basically. There's the Tommy in prison story, there's the Tommy out of prison story, and then there is, like in the last book, something that is seemingly tangentially related, but is definitely filling in the larger story. The first story of Tommy in prison has, you know, Tommy in prison, which, you know, you expect, and it's got a character, the prison director, who has... every opportunity to be just a single-dimensional character. And when he's first introduced, that's really all he is. He's the, I'm the tough-as-nails prison warden, and you're not going to get any special treatment from me.
Yeah.
And I think that Tommy's in prison for, like, three issues. And in each of these three issues, the layers of the prison warden get revealed a little bit more and a little bit more. We get introduced to his family and his life. And...
the reason why he's being such a hard ass to Tommy.
The reason why he's being such a hard ass to Tommy is because he is actually so deeply involved in the Tommy Taylor stories, which he tells to his kids. It's his connection to his kids. He deals in this sort of gray area of prison life day in and day out. He says how much he values the Tommy Taylor stories, because good and evil are clearly defined.
Yeah.
And so for him, he uses the Tommy Taylor stories to help keep that line very clearly defined for his kids, almost to a fault.
Yeah.
I mean, his kids have a tenuous grasp on reality because of it. But by the end of, you know, this character's arc, he is a fully realized character. He's not this single-dimensional guy. And... his kids are, like I said, they have a pretty tenuous grasp on reality, and they've really bought into the Tommy Taylor life, and they love to pretend to be wizards and Tommy Taylor's friends and all this. And when his kids see that he is not the, you know, bastion of good that they thought he was, that he is part of this gray area that really doesn't have any place in their life. I mean, he has set up the world to be good or bad. When they see that he isn't good and he isn't bad, he's a flawed man.
And he's actually
man.
Trying to kill Tommy Taylor.
Yeah, he's trying to kill
Tommy to them.
They can't see anything other than he must be under the control of the Count.
Uh-huh.
Now, everyone thinks they're crazy because the Count isn't real. He's a fictional character. But I think that that is the opportunity that the Count uses. That when Tom inserts the magic doorknob into the wall to create the passageway for them to leave, he is blurring that line between the magic and reality. And with him blurring that line, and the kids so firmly believing in the world that their father has created for them, I think that that release of energy sort of blurs their lines, and that's what allows the Count to sort of take over their father's body. I think that their belief, their such strong belief, coupled with Tom actually using magic in their world, sort of is that spark that brings it about. And there's, you talked about how there was the you know, all these websites and news stories that are in this book. There's reference to Jung's idea of there being this collective subconscious. And so I think that's what happens in this, is that these kids, their subconscious, their belief so strongly in this good, perfect world and bad world, and there no, you know, being no gray lines, I think they almost will the Count into existence in this case.
Sure. And it makes sense that if you have a hero, you have to have a villain.
Right.
And so once... Because if I remember correctly, Tom never uses magic in the first volume in any way that I can remember.
If he does, it's very accidental. It's very, you know...
Yeah.
It's not intentional at all.
And so when he uses the magic doorknob that can... make a doorknob out of a wall or make a door out of a wall by just sticking the doorknob in. It's obviously a magic doorknob.
Right.
It's his first active use of magic.
Right. First and conscious
so,
use.
Yeah.
Right.
And so he's becoming Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that same time, there needs to be a villain to counterbalance the hero. It's like the Watchmen idea, you know, where if you're going to have any sort of superheroes, there has to be super villains,
right,
that are going to be there.
Right. And that's, you know, like I said, and I'm not even sure if I'm reading it right that way, but, you know, that's part of, again, this sort of blurring that's happening is that, you know, it makes you just sit and think of how much of the, you know, subtext of this book is filling in for the story of the book.
Uh-huh.
You know, how much of this supplementary stuff is impacting the book.
Yeah. Which brings us to when he opens the doorknob, where he goes. We find out that he enters Yud-Suz. I don't know if I'm saying that right. It was a Nazi propaganda film.
Right.
That was a fictional film that was created in World War II,
mm-hmm.
To turn Germany against Jews.
Right. And it was a warping of a
Jewish novel.
Novel. Right.
Yeah. And so that's the world that we enter. And so this is really where the literary reference really picks up and takes off in this volume. Is we enter this world and we actually see Goebbels,
mm-hmm.
and they actually start to talk with Goebbels,
mm-hmm.
and we find out that just by focusing their attention on somebody in this imaginary world makes them more real and visceral.
Gives them substance.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know,
because it was kind of like a ghost world. They could walk through walls,
right.
and people and mm-hmm. stuff. It was as if they were real in a ghost world.
Well, and that's kind of the overall theme for this entire volume is, you know, making something that isn't real, real,
mm-hmm.
kind of willing it into existence. And there's even reference that Lizzie Hexham says at the end that Tom's father made her real, and she says the same thing about Tom that
yeah.
he is words made real.
Uh-huh.
And so here they are in this very ghostly world that as soon as they really focus on something, that becomes real.
Uh-huh.
And it goes back to that whole idea of, you know, making our own destiny and make, you know, the power of positive thinking, if you will. It's like if you think on something hard enough and you focus hard enough,
mm-hmm.
you can make it happen or real or.
I found
that
to be a really tense scene too, because as
mm-hmm.
as they were talking about how they said it right at the very beginning of the scene with Goebbels. And the whole time I'm just like, dude, do not keep talking to Goebbels.
Right.
Like, there's few scarier people in the world than Goebbels.
Yeah.
And I was just like, no, stop talking to him.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that, you know, they're basically, you know, sucked into him that, you know, he's talking and he keeps promising them, I can help you. Let me show you this. Now you show me what you have. And it was very, yeah, like you said, it was uncomfortable because, you know, he talks about, well, because you focused on me, you're making me more real. I can see you and I can talk to you. And he's got him just still talking and talking. And,
yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, it was creepy. And then I don't know where that, I got to tell you, that section of the book I did not find as fulfilling as the first section of the book. And the reason is that the conversation with Goebbels was very disturbing and had some very concrete, I don't know, parameters for me. There were rules to it, if you will. And then once they clock him with the projector and go to find Tommy, that's where it kind of derailed for me.
Yeah, I had a little trouble with that too, because all of a sudden the world kind of unravels into a kind of cloud.
Yeah.
Or something. And it really, I feel like we've been plodding along in this fantastical world with rules.
Right.
And all of a sudden we entered this area where it wasn't explained to us anymore, like why this was happening. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a satisfactory explanation.
And I'm still not sure how Tommy actually solved the problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand that that was a physical manifestation of the twisting that happened to the story. Uh-huh. And the ugliness and evil that was created. I get that.
Yeah.
But then Tom says, I know what I need to do, and he sticks out his hand and his magic tattoo shows up, and then all of a sudden, bam, it's a book.
Uh-huh.
And for me, I just didn't, I don't know, I needed a little bit more. I needed, like I said, it had jumped, there were two big jumps there. One, it had left this world where I was starting to understand the parameters and rules of it all, you know, and so now we had this big twisting cyclone thing. And then, while I was still trying to wrap my brain around that, he is already off solving it, and it involves him sticking his hand in it and his tattoo showing up. And so for me, there were two big jumps there that happened very quickly with very little explanation.
I didn't really feel that. For me, it was more that it had kind of built up to this, and we find out early on in this section of the story that Lizzie Hexham is like, you know, he said that he wasn't ready, Tommy wasn't ready for this part of the story, you know, we got to mm-hmm. get him out of here and stuff. And so there was this build up, and it felt like it climaxed with Goebbels, and then this big thing happened, and then bam, it was over, like before it even started, really. Right. And there was no tension there with it. And I get that he doesn't really understand it either, like what happened or how he healed it. But if that's so, then he did it incredibly easy for his father to be concerned about him being in there. And that's where I have the problem with where that story goes.
Yeah, because if this is something he shouldn't be able to handle yet, and it's the very first thing he handles, and he handles it so easily, where's the tension?
Yeah, that's what my problem was with that part.
And, you know, I thought the story was going to go was there was a sighting of the guy who was actually responsible for the murder at the end of volume one. And Goebbels actually, that's kind of how they get talking, is that Goebbels
knows who he is.
Yeah. And says that actually that guy kind of works for him. He's a messenger, a go-between. And so I kind of expected that to be the direction mm-hmm. the story went. Yeah. But once he said, I'm the go-between, or he's the go-between, that was kind of it. Oh, hey, let me show you this movie I made.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just dropped. And like I said, went a whole different direction that, like I said, it just kind of came out of nowhere and ended too quickly.
That one issue was really complicated for me, and I didn't find it satisfying.
Yeah.
So that was like the fourth issue, I'm assuming. And then the next issue is our delving into literary history or into a literary world where we don't see any of the main characters at all, and it's in a completely separate, fractured reality.
Right.
Kind of like the Rudyard Kipling
mm-hmm.
story. Mm-hmm. And so
it's the story of Mr. Bunn, or Polly Bruckner,
uh-huh.
and kind of a mashup of Winnie the Pooh and kind of
like Peter Rabbit
kind of. Yeah, Peter Rabbit. I was gonna say like Wind in the Willows, you know, Mr. Yeah. Toad's Wild Ride type thing, where you've got anthropomorphic animals who have a relationship with each other, and then life is idyllic. You know, there's a little bit of Beatrix Potter.
It's also a children's story.
Right,
like,
right. Except that Mr. Bun is a foul-mouthed, rude, you know, homicidal rabbit. Mm-hmm. And basically, he claims to not be Mr. Bun. He claims to actually be this, the consciousness of a man named Polly Bruckner, who somehow was transported into the body of Mr. Bun as a punishment by Tom's father,
uh-huh.
is the implication. And you and I were talking about this beforehand. We can't put our fingers on volume one at the moment, but there he talks about how one minute he's getting pounded into the ground by Tom's father, and then he wakes up in the body of this. In one of the flashbacks in volume one, Tom's father is beating a guy into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that wasn't actually Polly Bruckner, it's definitely, you know, the kind of thing that it sounds like Tom's dad was capable of.
Yeah.
And that was, again, I enjoyed this story a lot. This was, you know, like the last volume, this story is one of those stories that keeps me coming back.
Yeah.
Because it, while it has very little to do with the story of Tom directly, it has everything to do with the depth and richness of the world,
yeah,
that Tom, I don't even want to say is a part of, but has access to.
Yeah.
And it's great. I mean, it's
and builds upon that theme as mm-hmm. well, that central theme that we're starting to polish up now.
Right. Right. And, you know, it was very reminiscent of when we read House of Mystery, how each story would have a different artist and different
uh-huh.
kind of storyline, but that would somehow be very complementary to what was going on in the
yeah.
book. And that's the same way I feel about this. This one, like in Volume 1, is done in a different art style, a different narrative style, but really does a fantastic job of just being, you know, its own little piece of magic.
So is that Peter Gross?
I believe it is. I believe it's just him exploring a wow. different style.
It's a completely different style and a gorgeous style too. This was almost my favorite art. This one issue out of the mm-hmm. whole book. I mean, this art was breathtaking at times. Sort of like a painted watercolor.
Right.
Style.
And again, it's different from that from the main story. And it's different from the story that had Rudyard Kipling in mm-hmm. it as well. I mean, so he's getting an opportunity here to really flex some muscles and show us something else.
Yeah.
And then the covers. I mean, while we're talking about just art here, the covers are fantastic. I could stare at the covers for quite a while. There's lots of little hidden things in each of the covers that, you know, take a second and a third look
mm-hmm.
to really enjoy them and get in them. And then the use of negative space is fantastic.
Really design heavy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not detailed per se, but it's just really design heavy in how he uses the negative space, like you said.
Yeah, it's I'm saying top to bottom, cover to cover, this is a great series that, like I said, even though I didn't enjoy the, all right, you try it,
that's the one.
Although I didn't enjoy that one as much, I still feel like it did a good job of moving the plot forward in that it helped explain why Tom needs the map, what it is he needs to do with the different locations on the map, and it gives us some kind of inkling as to what will happen when he hits all the spots on the map. Because again, Lizzie talks about how he is to be the savior. He is to be the one who sort of brings, I don't know, what do you want to call it? Brings order to the chaos. And so, like I said, even though I had some problems with how those individual issues were resolved, I think that overall they did a good job of pushing the story forward.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't think that as two volumes, you can stand two other volumes up next to this and have it stand as well as a complete two volumes.
As a complete, right, right. And like you said, though, earlier, that this one is very accessible even without the previous one. I mean, definitely reading the previous one gives you a lot more insight into this. But again, were someone to just pick this one up, there's enough in this for them to grab onto that, you know, that they can. And again, it leaves us wondering what's going to happen, because the end of the first one was there's a big murder mystery and he's being hauled off to jail. This one, they've been gone for 3 months and the mysterious, what is it, 14th book or whatever is going to be released in 3 days.
The Tommy Taylor book. His father has disappeared like 20 years ago or something. Right.
And it showed up on the editor's desk mysteriously, you know, during the last volume. So now that's the big thing, is that Tom was just saying, oh, thank goodness I'm, you know, 3 months, the heat's off, you know, I'll be fine now. You know, I can go about doing this stuff with the map without always having to look over my shoulder. Well, you know that in 3 days' time, it's going to be Tom fever again.
Mm-hmm. So buy this series.
Buy the series. Support this series. Yeah. I mean, really, this is one that should be supported, should be enjoyed, and you know, show it to your friends. I mean, again, this is the kind of thing, this is the kind of book that you take and you say, hey, read this. You might enjoy this.
Especially English majors. Oh, I can't mm-hmm. They must get a nerd boner over that.
Well, this one felt adult to me. I mean, I don't mean that in the, you know, boom shikawawa way. I'm talking like this one, again, made me feel like this was a comic book for adults.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there are a lot of comics, even things I read from Vertigo, that I'll be like, okay, yeah, I mean, adults should, you know, read this, and adults will get more out of this than a kid, but I still don't necessarily feel like it's being written for an adult audience.
Mm-hmm.
This one is for adults.
Yeah,
one,
I think that a lot of books are written for like a teenager or something like that kind of adult.
Right. Yeah. You know, this one is written for adults. This one is written for, you know, someone who wants to sit down and really delve into something and think while they're reading and enjoy something that takes them deeper and then pulls them off in another direction.
I agree.
So pick it up and enjoy.
You have been listening to STR, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels.
Hello, me. Meet the real me. And my misfits way of life. A dark black past is my most valued possession. Hindsight is always 20/20, but looking back, it's still a bit fuzzy. Speak of mutually assured destruction. Nice story. Talk big, gotcha! Feeling paranoid to an enemy of phosphorin. Anxiety's attacking me. My air is getting thin. I'm in trouble. Me again. You can subdue but never tame me. It gives me a migraine headache, sinking down to your level. Yeah. Yeah, just keep on thinking it's my fault. And stay an inch or two at a kicking distance. Mankind has got to know his limitations. And cross the board with like the walls are closing in. Bloodstains on my hands and I don't know where I've been. I'm in trouble for the things I haven't gotten yet. I'm sharpening the axe and my palms are getting wet. Sweating wolf. To myself, a credit to dementia. Someday you too will know my pain and smile its black tooth grin. If the war inside my head won't take a day off, I'll be dead. My icy fingers claw your back. Here I come again.